The next day, when she accepted an award for Hurt on Cash's behalf at the CMT Flameworthy Video Music Awards, it was obvious to onlookers that she was unwell. Not only was she physically bloated as the result of the fluid buildup in her body, but also she was mentally confused due to the lack of oxygen reaching her brain. She looked disheveled and flubbed her lines. The show was broadcast live on television, and Cash watched it at home in the company of his producer, Rick Rubin. On April 11, 2003, she was admitted to the intensive care unit at Baptist Hospital, where she was diagnosed with congestive heart failure, though the doctors were unsure of how best to treat her. She developed a serious cardiac arrhythmia and had to be defibrillated, but she was able to sit up in bed and watch old videos of herself as she recovered. After 5 days, she was considered well enough to return home. On April 28th, she developed acute breathing problems. When her niece Kelly called at the home, the nurse was examining her. The nurse instructed, "Get her straight into the hospital for tests." Kelly called the couple's physician, Dr. Terry Jerkins, at Baptist Hospital and made arrangements for June to be taken in. In retrospect, Kelly believes that June knew she might never come home. Before she left the house, she had a brief conversation with Cash, in which she insisted, "I have to go, and you have to let me go." It was unusual language for June and seemed to have ominous undertones. "Don't worry about me," she continued. "I have to go now. You stay here and take care of yourself." Over the next 3 days, June underwent a full battery of tests. Doctors established that fluid on the lungs, due to disease in her heart's mitral valve, had caused her breathing difficulties. This inflow valve opens to allow freshly oxygenated blood to flow into the left ventricle of the heart so that the blood can be pumped throughout the body. When it fails to open or close completely, blood leaks backward into the lungs, causing buildup. The heart then has to work harder to compensate for the loss of blood, and this leads to heart failure, often recognized by its symptoms of fatigue and shortness of breath. The only solution was a replacement valve, but because June had taken prescribed blood-thinning medication during her Christmas vacation in Jamaica, surgery would have to wait until she discontinued the medication and her blood had begun to coagulate normally. June was apprehensive about undergoing major surgery at the age of 73, saying she didn't think she had the energy to cope. Cash pleaded with her to go through with it because it offered the only realistic possibility of extending her life. He told her how much he loved and needed her and said that for him, life without her would have no meaning. She eventually agreed, and May 7 was set as the operating date. The day before, her son, John Carter Cash, visited her with the contact sheets from Ron Keith's photo session. She looked over them in her hospital bed, and while Keith had done a good job, she wasn't happy with the way she looked. She looked ill, she thought. She suggested that they go ahead with an alternative cover. The operation went well. Doctors successfully replaced her damaged mitral valve with one made from an animal's aortic valve. Settled into the intensive care unit, ICU, and attached to a respirator, she surprised her doctors the next day by recovering enough to breathe unaided. Cash came in and spent 6 hours at her bedside in his wheelchair. Relieved that they had seemingly weathered the worst, they laughed with each other. June ate a dish of Jell-O. Cash told her that once he got back to the lake house, he planned to build up his strength enough to walk again. Rick Rubin had recommended a kinesiologist, Dr. Phil Maffetone, who would wean him off much of his medication and develop a program that would restore the withered muscles in his legs. Then, when they were both recovered, Cash wanted them both to fly to Germany to see their friends Walter and Monica Eschenbach. But after he left the hospital, June put a call through to Kathy, the second eldest Cash daughter and the only one living in the Nashville area. June still seemed breathless and unable to talk for long. She told her that although she was off the respirator, she didn't feel that she was going to make it. "You're going to be fine, June," Kathy said. "People have that surgery all the time. I'm sure that you're hurting so bad at the moment that you feel you're not going to make it." But June was insistent. "No, honey. I really need you to know that I'm not going to make it. Please take care of Daddy." Kathy didn't share the conversation with her father. He had gone home confident in June's recovery and looking forward to her homecoming. He'd even told Kelly that he believed June's speedy recovery had been an answer to prayer, because one of the doctors had told him that it was unusual for a patient to come off the respirator so quickly after such a major operation. He had remarked that she must have the constitution of someone 30 years younger, and that it looked like she'd be moved out of ICU into one of the private suites by the weekend. Early the next morning at 2 a.m., June suffered a massive cardiac arrest. It took 20 minutes for doctors to manually resuscitate her. They couldn't use a defibrillator because of the recent surgery, but the resuscitation was only enough to put her on a life support machine. She remained in a coma. Cash was called to the hospital immediately, and by early morning on May 9th, the family began gathering. June's daughter Rosie, John Carter, Kathy, and Roseanne. Because they were unsure of exactly how long her brain had been deprived of oxygen, the doctors would have to wait at least 3 days to see if June responded to any stimuli. If there was no response, they'd carry out tests. Kelly was shocked at the effect this was having on her uncle. To her, he had always been a man who was larger than life, a man who stared his own death in the face and didn't flinch. But now he was physically and emotionally broken. He looked defeated, and she had never seen him that way before. After the doctors explained the situation, she saw him take a deep breath. "Okay, I'm going to pray about it," he said, "and I'm going to go down and see her." For the next 3 days, the children based themselves in an eighth-floor suite. Every half hour or so, Cash would make his way down in the elevator to sit by June's bed. He held her hand. He talked to her. He prayed for her. He sang her songs and read her psalms. He begged her not to leave him. His longtime manager, Lou Robin, put out an appeal for fans to pray for her recovery, something he had done for Cash when he had been in a coma in 1997. Tests to gauge brain activity were carried out on Monday, May 12th, and then the cardiologist came up to the suite where everyone was gathered. The news, he said, was as bad as it could be. There was no brain activity. June was in a vegetative state. No one knew what to do or say, and every eye automatically turned to Cash in his wheelchair. It was the most heartbreaking moment they had experienced. Kelly was so overcome with emotion that she had to leave the room. Cash wanted to know what could be done, and the answer was nothing. The damage was irreversible. He then asked everyone to join hands while they stood in a circle and prayed. "If anyone has anything to say to June," he said, "you should say it now." Then he left the suite and went down to the intensive care unit, where he had to give permission for her life support system to be switched off. It was expected that her bodily functions would slowly close down and that within 3 hours she would be dead. But instead, she clung to life for 3 days. The next day, Cash's daughters Tara and Cindy flew in, as did June's oldest daughter, Carlene. Messages of encouragement were coming in from friends. Merle Kilgore and his manager, Kurt Webster, dropped by. John Mellencamp FedExed a letter. Chris Christopherson, Al Gore, and Billy Graham made phone calls. Whoopi Goldberg sent food platters for the family. Jesse Coulter, widow of Waylon Jennings, flew in from Phoenix, Arizona. Michelle Rollins, a close friend, traveled from Delaware. Godson Ted Rollins was there by the family's side. Cash sat by June's bed with the children as they took turns holding her hand or brushing her hair. Sometimes her eyelids would open and his hopes would be raised. "You know, I think they're wrong," he'd say. "I think she'll be fine. She's opening her eyes." At other times, he'd break down, something none of them had seen since his mother died in 1991. Then they'd hold hands and sing the gospel songs and hymns that she loved until they were all crying. The one they sang the most often was "Waiting on the Far Side Banks of Jordan." "I'll admit my steps are growing wearier each day. Still, I've got a certain journey on my mind. Lures of this old world have ceased to make me want to stay. My one regret is leaving you behind. If it proves to be his will that I am first to cross, and somehow I've a feeling it will be, when it comes your turn to travel likewise, don't feel lost, for I will be the first one you will see. And I'll be waiting on the far side banks of Jordan. I'll be sitting drawing pictures in the sand, and when I see you coming, I will rise up with a shout and come running through the shallow water, reaching for your hand."